Brian Nesbitt, welcome to Wyoming Chronicle. Glad to be here with you today. We're in Riverton in the midst of a two-day meeting of the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission. When I think of it, it's the commission's kind of like the school board, and you're like the superintendent, sort of.
That's a great analogy. Yeah. That's exactly what
now,
it is.
Now, yours is not an elected office, right?
No, it's not.
Nor are any of the commission members ever. The governor gets to appoint these positions, correct?
Yeah, the governor appoints all the commissioners, and he also appoints the director, but the commission does get a vote there, too. They have the opportunity to send the governor three names whenever the director's position is vacant, and then the governor makes a selection out of those three names.
So when you come on as director, which you did 5 years ago, is that right?
Yeah, just over 5 years ago.
You're pretty well in sync, at least for the most part, with what the commissioners are all about, and they know who you are.
Yeah, absolutely, and you're right. I'd worked in the agency for many years, and even at the administrative level when I was appointed to this job. So I had a good familiarity with the commission and kind of how the process worked and what their main charge in Wyoming law was.
Mm-hmm. These agencies that are asked to do the job of state government in Wyoming have enormous wide-ranging responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And you've got the top position now, sort of this top-down view, but that wasn't always true. You came up through the department, through different positions, had sort of the middle-out view as well. Mm-hmm. It's a wide portfolio, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. For the uninformed, what would you say the Wyoming Game and Fish Department does?
It does a lot, as you indicated. Yeah. Our responsibilities are diverse. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I was to define our primary charge, it's to manage the wildlife resources of our state in trust for the public. Mm-hmm. Wyoming law directs that the wildlife in our state is owned by the state. That covers a broad range of, you know, wildlife management covers a lot of areas. We have one charge that's not directly related to wildlife management, and that's we do oversee watercraft safety and enforcement in our state. So we have that responsibility too. That's a little bit not aligned with wildlife management.
So there's a watercraft, a vehicle issue almost. Mm-hmm. Transportation enters into it. Land management enters into it. Mm-hmm. The big game animals and the birds and the fish and the smaller animals, the administration of a big department, of course, the legislation, the funding, the rulemaking. It just, there's a lot to it.
There is.
Were you ever a little boy with a fishing pole in your hand thinking, I want to work for Game and Fish? Or what got you interested in this kind of work at the beginning?
Yeah, well, Steve, that's a great question. And it's one that I really like to talk about because it really influences the way I think about our highest priorities for the department now. And so I was very fortunate. I grew up in this state. My dad and my family gave me a lot of great outdoor experiences. It was fishing. It was hunting. I started hunting birds when I was 11 years old. I went to the Springer Special pheasant hunt when I was 12 years old. But what really hooked me on the department was I was hunting deer with my dad and his older friend in Deer Creek Park, south of Casper. I'll never forget this. And while I was on my very first big game hunt, then you had to be 14 in order to hunt big game, we were contacted by a game warden. And that game warden spent 30 minutes talking to us about what he'd been up to that day. And he talked about all these deer he'd seen and these people he'd talked to. And I thought, you know what?
That sounds great.
That's what I want to do when I grow up. I want to be a Wyoming game warden. And then I never lost sight of that goal.
Some academic training that you can do that helps you prepare for it. What, in your case, was that?
Yeah, so we required then and still similarly now require a degree in wildlife management or a related field. And so that's what I did my degree in is University of Wyoming Wildlife and Fisheries Biology and Management.
What's a typical first job after getting your degree in the department?
Well, you hope that it's as a entry-level game warden if you were on my track.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of other folks have an opportunity to work at like an aquatic invasive species check station, as a fisheries technician, as a biologist technician.
And it's a science agency, among other things, too. I meant to mention that, but of course it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, over half of our agency are wildlife management biology-based folks. Mm-hmm. So
you got this entry-level position as a game warden.
I did. I actually, then we had a completely different problem than we do now. Now we are we're really having to work hard to recruit wardens that are suited for this job. Then the year I graduated, they didn't even offer the selection process or the game warden exam, they called it then, because they didn't have any vacancies. Mm-hmm. And so I had to wait a year. And during that year, I went to work as a deputy sheriff in Albany County. Mm-hmm. And then the first time they offered the exam, I took it and was hired. And
what's changed in that area? Why is that? Why were there no vacancies then, and it's harder to recruit now?
You definitely, when you look back on time, there definitely is peaks and valleys. Mm-hmm. That are based on when large numbers of folks came into the agency.
Sure.
Most of our wardens, when they hire on, they retire from the agency. And so, you know, you'd see these kind of these groups of folks that came on. Mm-hmm. At the same time, and then they would all retire around the same time. And then there just weren't any, nobody was retiring.
Yeah.
And so, you know, recently we've had more turnover. A lot of that crop of game wardens that came in when I did or right before me have left and created a lot of vacancies. And then, you know, a lot of our responsibilities that we entrust game wardens to deal with have increased.
Well, you brought up an issue that applies now to you as well. You're planning your retirement here in just a few months, correct?
Yeah, I think middle of September.
Yeah. Why is now the time?
A lot of factors that play into this, but I think one of the things that I've insisted on when I decided that I was going to move and apply and try to serve in the senior levels of the department. Mm-hmm. I also did this in my military career as well. I had a separate military career. Mm-hmm. That you don't want to spend too much of your time in the really high pressure, high responsibility jobs, because you run the risk of not being able to be innovative and not being able to look at things with fresh perspective and not have the same fire. And I still have all that right now, and I think it's time to hand the keys over to the Ram 3500 that this agency is right now when it's running really well. Mm-hmm. And not wait till there's something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the timing is right for that.
Interesting. I recall an interview we did a couple of years ago with Cam Shawley, the superintendent. Mm-hmm. Of Yellowstone.
Good friend of mine.
I'm sure you know.
Yep.
And I asked him, after all this upward movement that he's had to the very pinnacle of the park job and one of the big jobs in the whole park service, these conspicuous ones, does he still get a chance to get on a horse and ride through Yellowstone? And he said, yes, I make a point of it. Are you still able to enjoy the elements of Wyoming wildlife and the outdoors that attracted you when you were a boy?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's easy to get tied in and focused on the crisis of the day and, mm-hmm. and all of the demands of the job, but it is really important to stay in touch with the resource, and I do that. In fact, you bring up Cam and riding horses, and Governor Gordon and I had an opportunity to spend some time in the backcountry south of Yellowstone last summer, and one of those evenings we rode up and met Cam.
Really?
At the Park Service cabin, and, yeah, and he cooked us a steak. So,
one of the things that the agency does is compile a list of accomplishments. Here's, we're looking back on the year just passed, and here's some things that happened that came up that some of which we planned for, some of which maybe we didn't, mm-hmm. but that we accomplished. And two of them, in fact, we did Wyoming Chronicle shows about. Mm-hmm. One was the wildlife highway crossing in western Wyoming,
mm-hmm.
And another was the restocking of the fishery at Saratoga Lake, where we stood there with Bobby Compton, I think it was.
Yeah, yep.
And he told us all about that. One of these things I have a feel I know had been talked about necessarily because it was such a big undertaking to build this big overpass for animals. And the other was sort of an unexpected thing that came on the radar and had to be dealt with. I'm sure, I guess the job has a mix of those two things, doesn't it? How much of what you do is sort of on your agenda, your to-do list, compared to things that the phone rings and Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah. I try to make sure that I spend most of my time being proactive.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of folks in the agency that are great firefighters. And good when the fire breaks out, I got folks that are very capable of handling mm-hmm. most of those.
Yeah.
There are a handful of those that I have to become directly involved in. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I probably spend about 25% of my time or less reacting. And I try to spend three quarters of my time being proactive.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the highway crossing for a moment. One of the things that we learned while we were there was that the Game and Fish has to have these partnerships with other agencies and other funding sources and other officials, and that I think people just don't understand. That's not something that the Wyoming Game and Fish Department funded and built. It's there
right.
with your department's input, but many of the things that you want to do, that you need to do, you have to reach out and become part of a much bigger group.
Absolutely. And I will tell you that number one partner on these wildlife crossing projects, and it's plural now, we have several under our belt right. and are working on more. Our most important partner is the Wyoming Department of Transportation. Hmm. They have that responsibility to upkeep, maintain, and build our highways. And so we can't do any wildlife crossing work without
right.
the Wyoming Department of Transportation. They're exceptional partners. Director Westby and I are good friends and work together on this all the time. Another very important partner in our state is the Wildlife Fund.
That's who we were with that day.
Yes, the Wildlife Fund they're an exceptional group of folks, small, lean, but extremely effective mm-hmm. at building partnerships, securing funding, generating the interest from the public and big donors. And so they've been critical. And our federal partners as well. You know, a lot of these projects occur as a consequence of big federal grants. It takes some talent and some hard work to do the right things to apply for those and convince folks that don't live here how important it is, but mm-hmm. we've been very successful at that.
This second project that you mentioned near Kemmerer, sort of coming about for kind of a different reason, a different spark to it from the original one, because this a pilot nuclear power plant is going to be built in mm-hmm. that small town, and the sudden increase in traffic is just sort of monumental and really unprecedented, especially on a little secondary road like this. And so I almost feel like you have no choice but to do this if you're going to be protecting both the people and the wildlife.
Yeah, absolutely. And that project and the projections for increased traffic drove a lot of that. But another part of it is that particular deer herd is extremely important to our state. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad we were able to get that thing funded. It's going to make a difference.
It strikes me that the mule deer has sort of a special place in the Wyoming wildlife profile.
People, they really value mule deer.
Yeah.
Wyoming has, I believe, the most prolific and valued herd in the country. It's the largest, the Wyoming range herd. It's got this really interesting life history and biology mm-hmm. with migration. And then the other thing that's important with mule deer is they occupy habitats that are important to a lot of other species.
Right.
They're kind of an indicator.
Yeah, that's the word.
An indicator of overall ecosystem health. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, the places that mule deer spend a lot of their time are important to sage grouse and pronghorn and elk mm-hmm. and a whole lot of non-game species, anywhere from bird species to small mammals that mm-hmm. a lot of times don't catch a lot of the limelight, but are very important to Wyoming. And our department has a charge to manage all wildlife in the state.
So you've been monitoring through collars and other means. Is it about 1,000 deer, or is it more than that?
Yeah, it's been more than that. We've done a lot of collaring work to learn about these animals and their movements.
And during this time, of course, last year, we're here in April of 2024, April of 2023, we were sort of reeling from this. In my lifetime, you and I have lived in Wyoming all our lives, I don't remember a winter worse than that one was. Mm-hmm. And of course, that had this devastating effect on the deer herd as well. Had the monitoring program that you're talking about now started before then, and this was just added on to the difficulty?
Very fortunately, this work in the Wyoming range specifically had been going on for 10 years, over 10 years. And that is going to be very meaningful as we watch this deer herd recover mm-hmm. because we have pre-devastating winter information, and now we're going to be able to watch them recover mm-hmm. and see how that works.
There are lots and lots of mule deer in Wyoming now, but only about, am I right in saying, only about half as many as Game and Fish thinks there ought to be?
Absolutely. We definitely have seen, and this is across the entire West, not just in Wyoming, but a decline over the last 30 years of mule deer populations. And people are pretty darn concerned about it, and we are as well.
About 250,000 mule deer in Wyoming now, roughly? Is that
a little north of that? Yeah, I think that the last I saw was around 300,000.
Oh, really? And you wish, or ideally, you'd like to see 500,000 or more.
Yeah, a pretty good marker is the equal to the population of Wyoming.
Interesting.
So the human population of Wyoming. Yeah.
What's been deer's difficulty over the past half century or so?
It's a mixture of a whole lot of factors that are coming together all at one time, and it does vary geographically around the state, but when you consider things like long-term droughts in certain parts of the state, and you consider things like cheatgrass, I mean, cheatgrass is the cancer of Wyoming. It creates monocultures, it outcompetes those native species that are so important to mule deer, not only grass species, but forbs and brush species. So, you know, mule deer are browsers. They don't eat a lot of grass. They eat mountain mahogany and sagebrush and those kind of things. So those kind of habitat issues, we know that in certain herds, the CWD, chronic wasting disease prevalence, is high enough to have population level impacts. We know highway collisions, when you have deer populations that are already having some struggles and challenges, that highway mortality can be additive and problematic. We are on the, you know, we're looking hard now at even competition with other species as being part of a problem. You know, we have growing elk populations, and in a lot of those places where elk populations are growing, mule deer populations are declining.
Interesting.
We need more information before we can draw exact parallels there, but that's certainly something we're concerned about. Look across Wyoming from when you and I were young. The amount of urban development around Wyoming's communities.
Even in Wyoming.
You know, some of the places where we've built subdivisions are in the middle of mule deer winter range. And so that's certainly been a problem as well.
And then you throw a terrible winter in on top of that, which reduced the herd by what gruesome percentage, do we think?
You know, certain places it was 70%.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe even 80.
Yeah. The gray wolf.
Mm-hmm.
What's Game and Fish's role these days with wolf management?
So we're on year six now of having state responsibility for their management.
Right.
And so really our role is very similar to that as of our role with regards to mountain lions and black bears. Those are other large carnivore species that we're charged with managing. We have robust monitoring for gray wolves, and as you're well aware, we only manage for them as a trophy game species with seasons and licenses and methods of take in the northwest corner of the state.
Right.
So that's where our responsibility lies. We don't have responsibility for managing them in the part of the state where they're listed as predatory animals. That falls, as with the other animals listed as predatory animals, that falls with the Department of Agriculture.
Interesting.
And is governed by a separate set of statutes.
There's an issue that happened earlier in 2024 regarding a man who injured a wolf on a snowmobile. He captured the wolf, he brought it into a business, showed it off for a while, then killed it. It's been generating lots of coverage, and there's been some talk about what Game and Fish's role ought to have been with that.
You know, we became aware of a potential violation of Wyoming law that we're charged with enforcing.
Right.
We investigated that, and we determined there was a violation of the law, and we charged the individual involved appropriately under the law.
Mm-hmm.
It's been adjudicated. We've completed our work. You know, there's the county certainly has an opportunity to give this a look and see if they believe there's any other statutes outside of game and fish statutes that are relevant here, but the incident was certainly unfortunate. I feel it was very disrespectful to Wyoming's wildlife. It does not represent the value people have for our wildlife. I have not talked to one person in the state or out of the state that said, well, that was a good thing.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate, but I think it's time to move past
it. Also unprecedented, right?
It is.
This is some sort of chronic issue that is happening all the time.
Never. I've been doing this for 29 years. I've never seen that behavior before. I know our people in this state, and I realize this happened. It's unfortunate, but it's not common.
All right. Here's another high-profile animal that's treated a little differently in Wyoming now. It exists, but I'm talking about the grizzly bear.
Mm-hmm. I'll start by saying that the recovery of grizzly bears in Wyoming from as low as maybe 136 bears in 1974 to a level now north of 1,000 bears, mm-hmm. is one of the, if not the biggest conservation success story in the world. Incredible success story. And my department has taken the significant role in that recovery. Our sportsmen in this state have invested now well over $50 million in their recovery. We've done a majority of the on-the-ground work with resolving conflicts between bears and people, mm-hmm. between bears and livestock. We've done a tremendous amount of monitoring, invested a lot of money in collaring bears and learning about them and figuring out, you know, putting together a grizzly bear management plan that works for Wyoming. And I say this with all sincerity, we've invested blood in this. We lost a person who was doing grizzly bear work, mm-hmm. In a plane crash. And so we're invested heavily. We're passionate about it. We're the right agency to manage grizzly bears. Mm-hmm. The reason that grizzly bears are still on a list doesn't have anything to do with biology or their recovery. It has to do with entanglements in courts. Mm-hmm. It's a travesty that we're not managing these bears, that the state's not, doesn't have that authority right now.
You've been watching this throughout much of your entire employment tenure, mm-hmm. with Game and Fish, not just as director, but well before that.
Absolutely.
On and on it goes.
On and on it goes. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember the first grizzly bear I ever trapped, you know, and I never thought when I trapped that first bear that I was going to be testifying in front of the Senate about why they should be delisted, but I've seen the full gamut. The long-term success of grizzly bear conservation in our state is going to continue if the state is in charge.
Let's talk about fish for a moment, a gigantic part of what Game and Fish Department does.
Yeah, so, you know, we're a headwater state.
Yeah.
Just
say, what do you mean by that?
The major river drainages all start at the tops of our mountains. Mm-hmm. Most of the water that runs through our state, with one exception, originates in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And that's a benefit to our state. Mm-hmm. What it creates for us is we have tremendous fish habitat and a lot of opportunity to provide angler opportunity to not only people that live here, but people that don't live here. Mm-hmm. So it's a heck of a neat opportunity. And then we have a reservoir system too that, mm-hmm. provides a tremendous opportunity for different types of fisheries than were here before we showed up here.
We like almost every type of fish in Wyoming, but not every fish belongs in every body of water, and that's something that falls under the department's purview as well, isn't it?
It absolutely does. And you know, Mother Nature designed things the way she did for a reason. Mm-hmm. And when you put something there that wasn't meant to be there originally, mm-hmm. it usually doesn't work out well. And we've had some terrible situations where somebody, probably with the intention of you know, looking out for their own personal interests,
right.
put a species in a lake or in a stream that didn't belong there. You know, and you put a voracious predator into a system that doesn't rely on predators, mm-hmm. it could be devastating. You know, putting a walleye in Buffalo Bill Reservoir was a bad thing.
Yeah.
Perch finding their way into Saratoga Lake was a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
We've got, you know, invasive burbot in Flaming Gorge, mm-hmm. one of our best fisheries in the state, and mm-hmm. it's had a very negative impact.
Mm-hmm.
The really good news here is that we do have a robust hatchery and rearing station,
yeah.
program, and we're able to provide a lot of fish, millions of fish,
millions.
All over our state, millions,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty darn cool.
I think I'm safe to say, if you're a Wyoming person, you have a little kid in your house, one of the really, really fun places to take that little person is to a fish hatchery.
You go to one of our visitor centers, one of my favorites is the Story Hatchery, and you see those young folks and the glimmer in their eye,
yeah.
when they're looking at those fish and they get to feed them, and it's pretty special.
Yeah. What's your successor's big challenge or two? As you see it.
So I mentioned cheatgrass, and I will tell you that the cheatgrass of the water are quagga and zebra mussels.
Yes.
And keeping those two species out of Wyoming's water is an absolutely has to be a high priority for whoever replaces me.
So far we've done pretty well with that, right?
We have. We don't have them in our water. We'd
yeah.
know it if we did.
Yeah.
And some other states around us have not been successful, but those mussels continue to get closer and closer, and we have to be ever vigilant to do our level best to keep them out of our state.
A year from now, you're no longer the director. What do you want to be doing in, say, April 2025?
Fishing will be definitely on a day like today when the sun's shining and to be able to be outside. And I'm very fortunate. I married well above my station in life. I married a sweet little ranch girl from Glendale, Wyoming, and we have a tremendous
statewide television. What's her name?
Penny Nesvik. Yep. And we have the opportunity to run our ranching operation on her long-term 100-plus-year family ranch.
Really?
And so we'll certainly be doing that. I intend to stay involved in some of the boards I'm involved with, conservation, wildlife-related kind of work. And then, you know, I might find myself involved in some other projects, but certainly not don't have any intentions of a full-time job where I spend half my nights in a hotel.
Yeah. I am happy to say the thing that we say to military servicemen, and you're one of those as well. Thank you for your service to Wyoming for since the 1990s, if not before. We're here in the Wyoming Chronicle with Bobby Compton of Wyoming Game and Fish Department. Bobby, tell us what your title is exactly.
Sure. I'm the Laramie Region Fisheries Supervisor.
Fisheries Supervisor, and that's going to figure into what we're talking about primarily today. We're here at Saratoga Lake, just outside the town of Saratoga. The issue of invasive water species around Wyoming crops up from time to time. It cropped up here at Saratoga Lake recently. You were telling me off camera it's not the first time it's happened here. Something particular about certain places makes it more likely to happen. Tell us what went on here over the past year or two that became alarming to you and to the department.
So in 2021, we had a graduate student at the University of Wyoming.
Really?
He was doing some survey work, and he was collecting smaller fish, so he had some traps out. And he gave us a phone call and said, "I think I found some small perch." So he found some yellow perch. They were born in 2021. They were 2 or 3 inches. Once we got a hold of them and verified they were indeed yellow perch, that kind of raised the alarm, because we've never stocked yellow perch in Saratoga Lake, nor do we have them anywhere in the watershed within the Platte Valley. The closest we have in the North Platte drainage with yellow perch is Glendale Reservoir, so pretty far downstream. And so that, once we could verify they were yellow perch, that's when we had conversations on what to do with them. Again, yellow perch, not invasive. We have some species in Wyoming that are listed invasive, and those are the quagga and zebra mussels and animals we're really trying to keep outside of Wyoming.
What's the word you'd use for it when they show up here?
What I would call is just unwanted and illegally brought in.
Yeah. The point you made is that yellow perch is a fish that does exist harmoniously in other parts of Wyoming, but it's not supposed to be here. Why is that such a big deal?
Yeah, you're correct. You know, we do manage for yellow perch as a sport fish. Appreciate their value. Anglers love them. Probably why, you know, they were brought in here. Somebody wanted to catch a yellow perch and not a trout. Yellow perch have a role, and in the food chain, in the food web, in many lakes. We were afraid here in Saratoga Lake that it would disrupt kind of the food chain, and that's one of the reasons that we acted. I could explain that in a little bit, but so there was going to be some direct impacts to the fishery here at Saratoga Lake with yellow perch, but kind of on the watershed scale, we knew they would likely escape from Saratoga Lake. So Saratoga Lake is connected to the North Platte River.
So the North Platte flows into it,
correct.
Flows back out from
yeah.
it. So, and that's how the fish can
right.
get out, and that would be an even worse problem.
Yes.
In the
yeah.
larger frame of things.
Yeah. So in the North Platte River, starts in Colorado, travels north, water comes in and out near Saratoga, but, you know, not too far downstream, you run into Seminole Reservoir, the Medicine Bow River, and then down to Pathfinder, Alcova, Gray Reef. And so it almost posed as a headwater source for perch that could escape and end up in all these other waters, including the rivers. And we just thought that was too big of a threat to live with them, you know, moving on and expanding in those reservoirs.
You say it would impact the fishery. The fishery that you want in Saratoga Lake is trout, right?
Correct.
What would the perch do to the trout? Would they just outcompete them? Would they attack them? What's the issue when they exist in the same body of water?
Primarily, it would be competition for food. You know, perch are not as predacious as, say, walleye or even a brown trout, for example, but they can be prolific. That's the other kind of life history strategy with perch is females lay a lot of eggs. They're very fecund. And so in a short amount of time, you know, 3 to 5 years, they can really expand to numbers that are amazing, really.
And they're more fruitful and multiply faster than the trout do.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, trout don't even reproduce in a lake like this. We get, you know, a fishery by stocking. But, you know, we have examples in other parts of the state. Two come in mind in the Sheridan region where perch got in. One is Black Hills Power and Light near Newcastle. Another one, Healy Reservoir, just east of Buffalo. And in both cases, the trout fisheries were abandoned, you know, in a short amount of time, just mainly because there were so many small perch. So once you have a lot of perch, they pretty much eat all the food. So there's not food for trout. So we don't see any growth in the trout, but the perch also don't grow. So then you end up with a lot of stunted 2 to 5 inch trout. And I just say, like, in general, if you or I were gonna go out and, you know, harvest some fish
for
a meal.
You want a trout bigger than that.
And you want a perch bigger than that too. You know, you might want a 7-8 inch perch. You know, that gives you enough food to eat. So in those cases, those lakes are so full of small fish that really there's not much of a fishery at all. And so they, you know, we walk away from them.
What is the story of Saratoga Lake? It's a man-made lake that's been here for half a century or so. Is that right?
Yeah. I think it was built in the 40s. It doesn't serve any true irrigation like many other reservoirs in the state.
It's here for recreation.
Primarily for recreation. You know, it's a unique situation in that the Wyoming Game and Fish Department manages the public access, the fishing, waterfowl hunting, and some wetland habitat below, but it's owned, a portion of it's owned by the town of Saratoga, and they really, there's a campground, and it's a great place, you know, for tourists to come in and spend a weekend either going into Saratoga or passing through. So it brings a lot of money into the town, the campground does, and when the fishery is operating at a high capacity and it's drawing in anglers, we know that that also brings in a lot of income to the town of Saratoga.
So again, just to reiterate, when the fishery is operating at high capacity the way you want it to, that means I could stand here on the shore or maybe go out in my boat and cast a line and reel in a decent sized trout. That's the desirable outcome.
Correct. And you know, Saratoga is at 7,000 feet. You know, it's a cold environment. It's ideal for trout, not only Saratoga Lake, but
the river,
the North Platte River, the Encampment River. It's one of the premier wild trout fisheries in Wyoming or the West. And so that's another reason we're trying to protect what we have in the river with these perch. But yeah, the Saratoga Lake, when it's doing well, we experience really high growth rates, and it's a phenomenal trout fishery too.
What's the difference then between a lake where you'd see perch but wouldn't care as much, and this one? Is because the lake is bigger or deeper or different temperature? Why would you?
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about what you had to do, decided had to be done to restore the trout fishery here. In a lake where you didn't take action, what would be some of the differences?
I'll just use Boyson Reservoir as an example. You know Boyson, close to your home. It's a large reservoir. It's deep. It also has a better food base for fish like walleye, you know, which is, you know, a lot of people travel to Boyson to fish for walleye. So, you know, it kind of has the tiers you want to support perch. So perch in Boyson, you could fish for, you know, they grow to nice sizes. They're typically not too prolific because the walleye can keep them down. But outside of walleye eating perch, you know, there's a lot of minnows for forage, and there's just a better food base to support those kind of top level predators. Here in Saratoga Lake, it's pretty simple. It's driven by aquatic insects, so scuds and damselflies and those sort of things the trout really like. There's also zooplankton that trout will eat. But as far as what can support perch and then even the next kind of little predator, we don't have that here. It's shallow.
How deep? But it's deepest roughly.
Max depth would be about 20, but on average it's about 6 to 8 feet. Yeah. And again, that kind of matches up to some of those waters shared in these shallow waters where it didn't really produce, you know, a perch fishery that people would want to go there to fish for. Yeah.
So there are different lakes, different fish, different unwanted fish in a different place. And this is something that Game and Fish, in this case, in cooperation, as you said, with a municipality, is called upon to deal with in some different ways.
We knew we had a problem, and there's many examples of this happening in other places. We talked earlier, whether it's, you know, Lake Trout in Yellowstone or walleye in Buffalo Bill, burbot in Flaming Gorge. Heck, we've had smallmouth bass and Sloan's, and it happens a lot. But here, we just thought we could catch it in time, so we could maybe eradicate the perch before they proliferated. But it was a small enough system where you could have a project with some chance of success.
And the thing that was decided in this case, and it's not possible to do in other cases and wouldn't be desirable to try, but when you say eradicate, the thing you did was essentially, let's use the word, you killed all the fish in the lake, essentially, and restocked only with the ones that were desirable, including some others. Am I halfway right there?
You're right. And likely the hardest thing I'll ever do in my career. I don't want to do that a ton.
You're a fisheries guy.
Yeah. I'm a fisheries guy. I love fish. And it's hard to make those decisions. But, you know, from our chief of fisheries, our director, we decided that we wanted to act and act immediately and not wait any longer, because we have examples of when we didn't, of what the results are. So what typically would take 3 to 5 years to plan, and there's a lot that went into it, whether it's finding the money, reaching out to the local community, the homeowners. It was very complicated, but we were able to do it in a year. The fisheries biologist, Chance Kirking, the spearhead of the project, went above and beyond. And again, nothing that we like to do, but something we felt like we needed to do.
You found, as it turned out, or you knew and realized maybe even to a bigger extent, there are other fish besides the perch that were causing a problem here, and they needed to be dealt with also.
Another reason why we decided to do it is that because Saratoga Lake is connected to the North Platte River, again, water in, water out, the fish in the North Platte River can come in here too. So it was actually treated in 1998. So a similar project using rotenone in 1998. At that time, we did it just to suppress the white suckers.
White suckers.
Yeah. So white suckers are native to the North Platte River. And we actually conserve them, protect them in other places in their natural habitats. But when they get in impoundments, they can, much like perch, just artificially expand to levels that are you would never see in natural habitat. And so what that happened here, they were very prolific. We watched that expansion through the years. And so when we knew once, you know, we treated the lake with rotenone, those white suckers would go away, that would again free up food that that you know trout compete with. The other thing too is that there's brook stickleback in the valley. They also got in. They're actually an invasive species, so a listed species. They were in the lake at high numbers, and another reason why we treat. In fact, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management out of Rawlins, they're aquatic folks. They helped out a lot on this project because they wanted to try to eliminate a source of that AIS that is spreading through the valley too.
So here you have a municipality involved, a state agency involved, a federal agency involved.
Yes.
You come together as needed to help each other solve a problem as you find it. And here's an example of it. And this happens in different ways around Wyoming. You mentioned the product rotenone.
Sure.
And it's a poison, correct?
I don't call it a poison as in it's toxic. So rotenone is actually derived from a root from a plant in the bean family in South America. And so when we get it as product, you know, in a barrel, it's ground. It's just pure ground rotenone root. You know, it's a pretty high concentrate. What we get it at and what we apply it at is two different things. So we apply it at a really low level and a very precise level. But why I wouldn't say it's a poison is it doesn't kill a fish or harm, you know, birds, others by ingesting. What it does is it doesn't allow the fish to take up oxygen. Okay, so any gilled animal, fish being one of them, they can't take up oxygen, and that's how they end up dying. But once that leaves the system, usually takes a week or two for it to kind of precipitate out, you know, it's gone.
It's gone from
the water. It's gone from the water.
Especially in the flow through that you have here enhances that, or might maybe accelerates it a little bit too, I would guess.
Yeah.
So the fish die, and this included the trout that that still were here. I presume the procedure then is the dead fish need to be removed from the water.
Yes.
How many fish were we talking about in this case?
Yeah, so here, like you said, we didn't really know what we were going to see. You always think you know what you have until you end up, you know, being able to see every fish you've got. We didn't count them, but we estimated to pick up about 10,000 dead fish. Again, an effort that I don't ever want to do again. That was really hard on all of our crew. We worked really hard with it, but we got about 70% white suckers, about 10% perch, and about 20% trout. So we did kill a lot of trout, really beautiful trout, and that was no good. It was no good killing any of those
fish. Yeah, it's too bad. I hear what you're saying about that, because your job is protecting fish, but in the larger sense, people who know what they're doing have experienced this before. People of game, fish, and science understood that this was the best chance to control the issue here in this relatively closed, small body of water. There's an opportunity to do it. What happens to all those dead fish?
In this case, we buried them. Yeah, we buried them.
There's some cases I think I've read about where if there's a fish die off for whatever reason, sometimes they can be put to some other purpose, but that's not what this was about.
Correct.
So then this lake's essentially sitting here without any fish in it. How do you put them back in?
First off, we want to make sure the rotenone's out of the system. And it's actually a pretty simple way in that we use what we call canary fish. So we'll immediately start putting fish in cages in the water. It's kind of like a bioassay. And, you know, if a fish gets sick or dies, there's still, you know, a toxic level of rotenone. But after about 2 or 3 weeks here, fish were surviving. We were using trout. They were surviving, so we knew the rotenone was out. And we also did a ton of netting. So we had a lot of gill nets all through fall just to confirm that we, you know, didn't have any fish left. So that happened. Actually, the lake stayed fishless all winter. And then starting in spring, after we got a fish screen in to stop white suckers and brook stickleback from coming back, we wanted to start bringing water back in and fish back in. So we turned on the water, and then we started stocking trout in the spring.
I would say stocking trout. There's a fish hatchery near Saratoga.
Yes.
Is that where you went for these?
Yeah, you know, it's a unique situation in that we typically don't use a lot of fish from the Saratoga National Fish Hatchery. You know, they have different obligations, whether they're raising fish for the Wind River Indian Reservations or fisheries around the U.S. for that matter. We typically stock fish from Wyoming Game and Fish Department hatcheries, but in this case they did have some really, really nice rainbow trout. The community felt strongly about using, you know, or receiving fish from, you know, their local hatchery, so it worked out in that we stocked about 12,000 near catchable rainbow trout from Saratoga Fish Hatchery.
How big is near catchable?
Yeah, they were 8 to 9 inches. When this lake does not have suckers and, you know, the bugs are back, we could expect fish to grow, you know, 4 to 8 inches in a year. It's a really, really phenomenal growth.
So they come over in a, how are they transported from the hatchery to here? In
a hatchery truck with that has a, you know, an aerated tank.
I think I've seen this. There's a big hose sort of, and you just.
Yep. Actually here, you know, they just back up
really
to the boat ramp.
Because there's strong flow through inflow from the river.
Yeah, it's just that you get enough depth and you could just stalk the fish right into the lake.
They want to swim.
Yeah, they swim away.
Once they get in there. Now that must be fun to do.
It's fun. It was wonderful to see these fish back. In addition to the rainbow trout, we stocked some tiger trout. That's a sterile cross between a brook and a brown trout.
Why put them there?
We did them and brown trout. The reason we put those two fish in, a couple reasons. One of the reasons, and we've been surveying and talking to the anglers here for years, one of the complaints, if there was one, was there was not enough variety of fish, you know, and that it appears that, you know, yellow perch were one they wanted, but we heard that loud and clear. We just knew we couldn't stock other non-trout, but so to get a little more variety, we now are stocking tiger trout, brown trout, rainbow trout. The other reason we did the tigers and the browns was they're more predaceous, so more willing to, you know, eat fish. And the thought is if those white suckers or brook stickleback end up in the lake again, we want to have those predators, the brown trout and the tiger trout, big enough to, you know, to feed on the few you know, white suckers or stickleback if they get in here, and provide a variety.
Yeah, these predatory trout don't eat other trout. Is that what you found?
They will eat other trout. It's just that we stock the trout just like those Saratoga National Fish Hatchery. If they're stocked at, you know, 5 to 8 inches, they're too big to be consumed. So you can still have both.
How do we think this happened to Saratoga Lake? How specific is the knowledge of why the perch got here?
You know, we can't say for certain how, but it's highly likely that, you know, somebody took it upon themselves to, you know, catch them in another spot, transport them, and then release them. And
so that's so people would go to the trouble of catching a fish and keeping it live in a cooler or something and bringing it here just to establish them here so that what they could fish for those.
Yes. Now we spent the whole summer trying to figure out if that happened. So, you know, we started by just talking to our neighbors, or, you know, our colleagues in Colorado with Parks and Wildlife. We wanted to know, do they have fish in the upper headwaters of the North Platte? Have they stocked them? Have they ever permitted private fish stocking? Have they ever seen any? You know, and the answer was no. We don't believe there's any perch above, you know, upstream of Wyoming. Then we spent a lot of the summer sampling the river, seeing like maybe they're already established in the river and they came in, or if they've already escaped and there was a population established from here. So after we did all that, we also reached out to Saratoga National Fish. Have you ever had them? No, they haven't. And then finally, you know, then it's like, well, maybe, you know, people would say that we stocked them and maybe they were in a load of trout, but we've never had perch, you know, on any station, any hatchery in Wyoming.
Well, we're pretty careful about that.
Yeah, we don't stock yellow perch.
If you had been able to determine down to an individual or a few who had done this thing that we talked about, deliberately caught the perch elsewhere, come here to release them, that's a crime, isn't it?
It's a serious crime. In fact, I think within the last 10 years or so, we've changed, you know, some statute to increase the penalties for illegal introductions. Our legislature has been very supportive of that. In fact, I think we have some of the toughest laws in the West.
There's no closed fishing season in Wyoming, except this was clearly was closed for fishing for a while. Is it open now?
It's open to fishing now, yeah. And, you know, another thing that goes on here in Saratoga is a very popular and renowned ice fishing derby. It would have been the 40th year last year, and they actually had to cancel it. Another unfortunate problem with the, but it will be back this year. I think the fish will be of size, and I think it'll be really fun. I know, again, thank the town for being patient with us, and I know they lost a lot of money last year with that, but we're getting there.